This is Brad Stevens of the Boston Celtics. You're listening to New Hampshire Celtics Station, WKXL 1039 and 1450.
Welcome to Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 1039, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. It's time for our regular chat with Chris Nunu, Governor of New Hampshire. We'll have some special guests on the program as well today. Senate President Chuck Morris will come over to talk about the legislative priorities for the Republican-led Senate. And also Kerry Morton, who is the Director of Hope on Haven Hill, will join us as well. Dean Spodus with me today as co-host from Southern New Hampshire University and, of course, the Governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll start off with some news, a press conference today in which you announced a temporary pause, a hiring freeze. How would you categorize the...
Well, yeah, not a hiring freeze. What we did today is we've been going through the budget process. The budget is not as rosy of a picture as a lot of us were led to believe, you know, 5-6 months ago when we were seeing headlines of hundreds of millions of dollars in surplus and all that kind of stuff. It's not dire either, but it does require some real management. And so what we've done is we've simply gone out and asked the commissioners to not freeze their hiring, but really come to the executive branch, come to the governor's office, and let us know what hires they're going to be making. And so we can kind of put a little checks and balances on the needs of those hires. If there are things that we can hold off for a little while, we want to be able to do that. If there's areas where we think there's duplication of services or someone else can be doing that work going forward, then, you know, we want to be able to just provide that scrutiny, if you will. That's a little bit of a negative word. But we've also asked them to come forward and give us a plan for how they anticipate their equipment purchases. We have tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of potential equipment purchases going on in the next 6 months. What is truly needed? What can we go without for a little bit? Because we do have a budget deficit. Right now, we just, even within Health and Human Services alone, we're looking at a $65 million hole. That's a lot. But if we manage, we can probably fill that in a little bit. And so when we get to the end of June, when we get to the end of the budget cycle, we're not in quite a difficult circumstance.
How do you go about determining your priorities going into this budget? Because as we've talked about, there are certain things you want to invest in this state and will pay long-term dividends and will address some of the issues that the state is facing in regards to workforce development, customer service, education, making sure that children get a better education in this state, infrastructure. But you're also facing, as you described, not as rosy a budget picture as you anticipated. So where are you going to draw the line in regards to investment? And are you going to, you know, look at areas, as you mentioned before, where perhaps a vehicle is not needed or new purchases are not needed?
Sure.
And is this any spending that we're going to see, is it going to have to pay some sort of a dividends, you know, down the road?
Absolutely. And you know, the way I prioritize, just speaking for myself personally, is it's about the individuals, right? What are the things that we need to do in this state today that are going to have the highest and best effect for the individuals that, frankly, are suffering the most? So when we look at the substance abuse crisis, that is always going to take one of our top priorities because it just impacts so many different lives in so many different ways adversely, and we need to stay right on top of it. When we look at the DCYF issue, those are kids. A lot of times those are abused children that are being neglected, where we can provide some support services and really, again, help protect those who can't protect themselves, frankly. These are the types of things that we really need to address. We have issues over at corrections where we've been massively understaffed for years. So what are we going to do there to make sure that we're staying competitive to being able to bring in those hires? The prisons are a 24-hour a day entity. You can't really shut those down. So there are safety concerns over there for our state employees. So how are we going to address those? So these are just an example of the things that have direct impact on the health and safety of individuals in this state, and that's always where our top priorities are going to be.
Yeah, Governor Sununu, you've talked on the campaign trail and also since your inauguration about visiting, I think it's 100 companies and trying to you know, convince them to move into our state. You know, we've heard a lot about the issues with, you know, there just aren't enough people to fill jobs, got high energy prices. You know, I've heard from a number of sort of business owners that there are a lot of concerns about, you know, how they deal with these issues. How do you make the case to these companies that now is the right time to move to New Hampshire, given these concerns?
Well, first, again, I rely a lot on my background, right? My background, not just as an engineer, but a former business manager, business owner here in the state. I'm no longer with Waterville Valley, but there were a lot of skills garnered from that management, and being able to bring and talk as a former business leader or business leader to business leader, because I understand the issues that they're going through. I understand what it means to have high energy costs. I understand what healthcare costs, how they can impact a business. And I also understand what flexibility not just the state has, but businesses are looking at. So when you know those variables, the discussion is much easier. Also, you have to have a one-on-one conversation. It isn't about sending emails or just picking up a phone and hoping someone returns your call. It's about getting in the car as the governor, bringing down not just a bunch of bureaucrats, but the right team. And a lot of those are other business leaders in the state that can provide that support for why New Hampshire provides such an opportunity for those businesses. And then you lay out kind of the plan. And it could be a reduction of business taxes. It could be providing more competition with healthcare. It could be being aggressive with energy costs, which we are going to be. Not going to turn around tomorrow. But businesses want to know you're not thinking about just tomorrow. You're thinking 3, 5, 20 years down the road. That's the long-term vision that we need to get back to here in the state on the legislative side. And is that going to, and that is in turn going to give confidence to the businesses when they're deciding whether they're going to make the leap into
New Hampshire. One quick follow-up, particularly on energy costs. You know, the two big issues obviously are supply and the actual cost of power and electricity.
Supply determines cost.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there are some, if you look at our governorship as an institution, there really are some limits on what the governor can do to, you know, get companies to build pipelines or, you know, get the electric grid to lower prices. So what are your sort of your kind of key steps to move those?
Yeah, the governor doesn't build the pipeline. The governor doesn't, you know, drive, you know, start rolling out the Northern Pass Line or anything like that. But what the governor can do is work with those companies and provide a pathway to success to getting those projects done. So, for example, we talk about natural gas. I think we all agreed, whether it comes to New Hampshire or Connecticut or Vermont, we're all part of the same grid. We do need more natural gas into New England. But in New Hampshire, if that project is going to go forward, we have to do it the New Hampshire way. So that means working with the local communities, which was not done in the last project. And the last project, as you know, was kind of driven out of here last year.
Yeah.
But sitting down with those communities, understanding what those stakeholders, what their issues are, and letting them be part of that plan. And I'm happy to take the lead, to sit in those meetings and sit in those discussions and foster a better cooperation between the local communities and these project developers.
Rather than just having the communities kind of duke it out with the pipeline companies on their own.
And again, and that's when, I mean, what we saw last time was a natural gas company come in here and just drop their plan on the state and say, this is what it's going to be. Well, not in New Hampshire. We don't work. We don't do it. That is not the New Hampshire way. That is not the way we work. And so, again, to not just sit back, as I think some other folks in leadership positions have, and say, well, we'll just wait to see how that plays out. It's about getting involved in the process and being part of that solution. That's what governors can do. So you take, whether you're talking about natural gas or Northern Pass or a better renewable energy portfolio, all of these things have to come into play, and the governor can foster a lot of those projects along.
In your inaugural address, a big focus was on, you know, customer service and improving customer service for the state. And you talked a little bit before about what's going on with Health and Human Services. Are you going to do improving customer service? What does that look like? Are you going to kind of go across the board and have each, you know, agency do something that is similar? Is there going to be a commission, a blue ribbon commission, as we talked about before?
No blue ribbon commission.
It's going to take a look at, you know, what each department does and have a kind of a thorough audit, if you will, of the departments. So how are you going to get to, you know, the
how
point
do
we
get
where
from
you
here
make,
to there, right?
Where you make the decision? Like, what type of you've mentioned data and, you know, the analysis, and there's not a lot of that exists currently in state government. So how are you going to go about gathering the data and then making the informed decision to improve customer service and delivery of services?
Well, it's, again, so I'm not a big fan of blue ribbon commissions and studies and all that kind of stuff. That's a lot of talk. I'm more about the action. So. Whether it's looking at, there's a couple different areas, and in each department, how they deliver better customer service is really up to them. How Fish and Game does it might be very different than Medicaid,
right,
which is very different than education, because your customers are different, right? In education, it's about the kids and the parents and making sure those families are helping design a system that best meets their needs. Or in Medicaid, it could be about making sure that folks can get themselves or a loved one onto the Medicaid rolls. Look, at the end of the day, we have to make sure we're getting people what they need and get the government out of their way. I mean, people should not be wasting time and money and effort trying to negotiate a governmental path that simply should be providing a much more simplified system. So it could be everything as simple as how are they interacting on our websites, right? It isn't just about websites, of course, but a main one of the first things that most people do now is they'll jump on your website to see what services are available or how are we explaining ourselves. How are we providing that easy access interface? When people pick up a phone and call someone in government, are they getting a recording or are they getting an actual human being that can direct them into the right place to go? Are we telling folks with substance abuse, well, we can't help you today, but call back tomorrow with your insurance information and we'll see what we can do? No, that's not the answer for these people. So it's just about it's not about really data gathering. The data we need to gather is in many ways that anecdotal evidence of someone has a problem, this is how the system failed them, mm-hmm. and going and addressing that issue. And again, part of my call for a review of the rules and regulations, what are we doing? Are we overcomplicating it for people to want to come in here and get a job? Why do we have 130 occupations in this state that require government oversight? Is that really necessary? Of course, some of them do. But we're one of the highest in the country. The live free or die state is one of the most regulated states in terms of professional certifications. What are we doing? So it's a little bit of a common sense approach. Now, as we go further and further down the line, that's when we'll get into more of the hardcore data gathering and understanding some of the nuances of it. But, boy, there are some things just staring us right in the face. I sat with the developmentally disabled community today, the managers of all the area agencies, where they were describing to me in just 5 years ago to today, the amount of paperwork they have to fill out is astronomical. And they're spending all their time and effort filling out paperwork as opposed to getting families the services that they need. That's wrong. Something is broken in that system. So I want people to bring those examples to me, bring it to HHS, find out where we can do better, break down the system a little bit, and really cut through the red tape. I mean, and it literally is red tape that is affecting these families from getting the best services and the best quality of product that we can provide.
That's Governor Sununu. I am Chris Ryan, along with Dean Spodus. This is Pints of Politics, the Barley House, on 1059, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com, presented by New England College. We'll come back and talk with Senate President Chuck Morse, and also a great New Hampshire success story, Kerry Norton from Hope on Haven Hill, still to come here on Pints of Politics at the Barley House. Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, 1059, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com, presented by New England College. I'm Chris Ryan, along with Governor Chris Sununu and Professor of Political Science, Dean Spodus. We're honored to welcome in now in our first guest segment in the program today, Senate President Chuck Morse. We talk about the legislative priorities for him in the United States Senate. United States Senate, giving you a little bit of an upgrade here. New Hampshire Senate, along with the governor. Appreciate you joining us, Senator Morse.
Well, thanks for having me. And it was governor 2 weeks ago, so right. United States Senate this week would be great.
Former governor, that's right. Former
New Hampshire governor. That's how I should. If I had any brains at all, that's how I would have introduced you, as former New Hampshire governor. This is the first time we've had two governors on the program at the same time, I think.
Well, I'm happy to give the title to Chris. So it's.
And I'm happy to take it.
Chuck, it was a peaceful transfer of power.
It was a peaceful transfer of power. He did a great job. He did a great job in the 48 hours that were.
So for you, Senator Morse, talk a little bit about, you know, what your priorities are going into the budget, and how do you, you know, plan to mesh those with that of the governor? Obviously, you're both Republicans, but even within a party, individuals have different priorities, things they may want to spend money on. He's talked a lot about, you know, obviously full day kindergarten and finding funding for that. Where do you see the things that you're definitely agreeing on and some of the things that you think that there may be some disagreement?
Well, to start with, I mean, you know, Chris coming in to be the governor, obviously we're going to look to him for delivering a budget on February 9th that we can support, which I believe he's doing. So you know, building budgets in the state of New Hampshire, I've always said you have to live within your means. It's going to go through a debate. Governors need to accept that there's 424 people in the House and in the Senate that want to go through and rehash everything the governor submitted. And I think we'll work well together. I mean, I believe we'll go through that process just fine.
It's going to be great.
How do you see the announcement today in regards to the, not a hiring freeze, but a hiring pause, we'll call it, where any new hiring has to go through the governor's office? Does that have a direct effect on the budget and planning? And is it a wild card that neither of you were expecting?
Well, I think Chris making that announcement today is what needed to happen. I mean, I honestly believe in all the years that I've worked on building budgets and helping build budgets, we've not missed, and we've certainly delivered what the people in New Hampshire expected to deliver out of the budget. For us to be off by $65 million now going into the new year, I have concerns about it, and I think the governor is expressing that today, and I think we'll work to make sure that that gets taken care of.
And if I may, I think the most important part is we're not turning to the legislature saying, okay, now go write a $65 million check to fill the hole. That isn't good management. That's no management, right? Anyone can do that. We're really going back to the commissioners, specifically Health and Human Services, but really everybody, because it is a collective solution that we need here, and saying, okay, what can we do? How can we manage through this and find the savings that that we haven't kind of pushed ourselves a little bit on the executive level to find those savings in the first 18 months? Of this budget cycle. In the last six, we can still make, I think, some great strides. And hiring is a big piece of it, controlling costs on equipment purchases. Again, this isn't an executive order. We're not ordering anyone to do anything. We're simply saying that to the rest of the members and within the executive branch, that being the commissioners, let us help you manage the problem, because it is a statewide problem. There are clear priorities where we have to put additional dollars, right? There are clear holes where things come up that have to be addressed. So it isn't just a matter of getting back to kind of that zero base, but really making sure that we do have additional funds there to address the priorities and the needs of the state. And the last budget was tremendous, a tremendous job by both the Senate President here, Speaker Jasper. These guys put together an outstanding budget, and I think history will prove out. It's really one of the best budgets we've seen in the last 20 years, to be honest. But with any budget, it isn't just writing the piece of paper. You then need to make sure that you're managing it. And we're just trying to provide that extra oversight and that support to those commissioners to get the job done.
How do you guys feel overall about the Health and Human Services Department at this point, where this is another issue that they have had, being in this situation, and this comes in line with DCOIF, it comes in line with the security breach. Are you two beginning to lose faith in that department and their commissioner?
I wouldn't say we're losing faith. I think we have concerns, like anyone else in the state of New Hampshire, that department has grown so large that it needs additional management. I think the governor is going to provide a lot of that, which I think is extremely important right now. And the department itself, look, one of the things I offered in the last budget was talking about, let's take 100 employees and turn it into 35 managers, because what I see is, in this day and age, lawyers, accountants are needed in that department to make things work. And I'm not so sure we shouldn't have done that in this budget, because we're dealing with large companies like MCOs, and we need to have that expertise on our side.
I think the Senate President has hit it right on the head. It isn't a lack of faith. I have faith in Jeff Myers in his ability to be the head of that department. But we do need to provide some assistance, because it's just gotten so big and so unwieldy. And with what we're seeing, for the last couple of years, we've had just an onslaught of different regulations and everything from the federal government, trying to manage all that at the scale, not to hundreds of millions, but to the scale of billions of dollars, is a pretty large task for any single individual. So to Chuck's point, putting some more management in there, the idea of taking 100 employees and making them into 35 managers, I think that's a great idea. That's the type of stuff that we're looking for. And I think, again, depending on where the federal government goes with a lot of the HHS spending, which is drastically going to change without a doubt, we're going to have the ability to provide and create a lot of efficiencies in a system that right now is just it's just overbearing.
One of the topics on today's show is addiction and recovery. We were talking now about Health and Human Services. A related area is mental health in the state, and we've been hearing recently some concerns that maybe the state is not quite living up to the requirements of its legal settlement to transition people to more communal living situations where they can get the kind of treatment they need. How do both of you gentlemen see that fitting into the budget, the ability to fully fund what is necessary going forward? Governor, is it as you suggest with other HHS issues, an issue of efficiencies, or will we need to direct more resources at the problem through the state budget?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of more resources. Not to be repetitive, but it is a matter of management. So it's about bringing the mental health community, those on the front lines, together with the state, together with those in the managed care organizations right now who are part of this kind of three-legged stool, if you will, and bringing everybody together and not kind of being so hands-off. I think we've been a little bit of hands-off on the issue, assuming that it would all just work itself out.
So you think the capacity is there, is sort of how it's being
absolutely
sort of utilized. Okay. Yeah, Senator, your thoughts?
Well, I agree 100%, and I've told the governor that. I mean, in our meetings in December, we talked about it. I think, you know, the approach has to be from the executive administration that they're going to be in charge of this and they're going to, you know, manage the process. Because I think that's what's happened. I mean, we've certainly appropriated a lot of money to mental health. We've certainly put a lot of money into the Medicaid system. And now I think it's time to manage that system. And we need to start to look at that. I mean, look, New Hampshire with 2.7% unemployment, I mean, our state is virtually has to start looking back to people that can come in and start to help us, too. So I think there's opportunity here.
Well, that's interesting. That's a very clear statement from both of you, because there are some in the state who believe that there's just not enough being resources, not enough resources being directed at the problem. Both of you are presenting sort of a different
view. You could throw another $100 million at that problem. If you're not bringing in the workforce to address, as Chuck is talking about, the workforce to really help manage that and help doing the caseloads, whether you're talking about mental health, the DCYF, the mental health issue, the DD community, all these folks have real workforce shortages. We have a massive nursing shortage here in the state. So that's going to be in part of our economic development plan, if you will, as we go forward. That's a big part of it. How do we drive the workforce in here?
And do you believe in terms of workforce development, recent estimates show there's about 20,000 good-paying jobs available in this state right now. And I believe Senator Bradley and Senator Feltus have filed a piece of legislation in regards to workforce development and kind of syncing up the entities, the individual who may be looking for the job or is thinking about looking for the job, the educational aspect and the governmental aspect. In your view, what's an optimal approach to the workforce development problem, Senator Morse?
I think it's everything above. I honestly believe we got too many hands, you know, right now in the fire, and I think the governor is going to lead on this, and I think he's going to create a solution where everybody's working together, because I do believe it's education. I do believe, you know, we have to have work requirements for people on Medicaid because there's a whole workforce there that we're not tapping. I also believe we have issues in the state of New Hampshire where young people want to come back to New Hampshire, but they want to come back to communities they believe in. I mean, when I was growing up, everybody wanted 2-acre zoning, and they wanted to live like that. Now people want to live and work and play in the same area.
Right.
Salem's doing it. They're doing it up. There's a project in Derry going forward. There's a project up in Bedford going forward, which is exactly what these young people want, to come back to New Hampshire. But I think it's going to take that. I think it's going to take some redesigning of government to make sure that we go forward and create the atmosphere that we want you back here in New Hampshire. And that's what we're going to start working on. And I know the governor is enthusiastic about this.
And again, yeah, I think Chuck's hit it right on the head. It's all of the above. But, you know, he touches on something that people forget. The housing issue is a big issue here because, I mean, we have folks that are putting forth projects that provide quality, lower-level and mid-level workforce housing, some subsidized, some not, and it's taking years to get those projects permitted. Years, right? Those projects should be fast-tracked so they can be permitted in about 2 or 3 months so we can get the affordable housing up so these folks can come back in and we can provide them, again, what they're looking for. There's a very different dynamic between – look, I'm supposedly the youngest governor in the country, but I don't consider myself that young, I suppose. But just what folks are looking for, what young people are looking for today versus just 5 years ago or 15 years ago, it's very different, right, in terms of what is going to drive them into a new area. There's a whole urbanization going on in this country right now. Everyone wants to be in the big city, right? So we have to appreciate that and understand, okay, well, what are we doing in our cities to allow those young people, those young families to want to move back into a more of an urban area? What are we doing in the North Country as well, where we have so much opportunity? What are we doing with our energy costs and our healthcare costs to keep businesses from leaving, right? It's not just a workforce issue. We have other issues at play that are, again, driving some companies out. When young people hear that companies are being driven out of the state, we're getting put on the back burner for someone in terms of wanting to come in. So all of these things really have to be considered. I am going to go out and start attracting new businesses. And people say, well, why would you go look for new businesses if you can't fill the jobs that you currently have? Because when you put them all those pieces together.
I like when you ask the questions for me.
That's what I do. Yeah. That's what I do best. It's the engineer in me. But really, when you put all those pieces together, you have to make this an attractive place. We have to be the place that's really moving forward. And then to Chuck's point, we have to promote it. right? We have to promote it. Do you know in this state as well, we have 130 professions that are licensed or regulated, one of the highest number in the country, right? Is that preventing us from potential allowing more people to come over? Because, well, it's just as easy to go to Massachusetts and have the same job because they don't have all the regulatory burdens that you might have in New Hampshire. In this state, we're also ranked 37th in the country in terms of state regulations holding small business and individuals back, right? That's not good. That's not a good number. So, you know, I call for a review of the rules and regulations in part because I just think there are things we can do within the state, break down those barriers, and really finally say to the country, to the businesses, to the workforce out there, we are open for business and we are going to drive forward.
One more quick thing in this segment.
Senator, this one's for you. Now with a Republican governor in the corner office, you're a lot less likely to face a veto on business tax cuts in the budget. What are you looking to put in there? Where do you foresee the state going in terms of tax cuts for business over the next 2 to 4 years?
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear, 15 years ago, I was young. So the
I was
governor
say, it's
hasn't
all
captured
relative,
that.
Right.
You went to school with my sister.
And I'd
you're
like
still
him
young.
To tell his sister that.
I thought you looked like Phil Donahue for your entire life.
I think we're going to work together with the governor. I think we have to be responsible as Republicans here. We are going to talk about lowering BPT and BET. I think those are the taxes that will draw businesses into New Hampshire and make businesses that are here grow. Those are the ones that we're going to look at lowering. And
Same sort of funding mechanism that you set up for the last budget cycle, do you think?
Well, I think we have to look at how the growth has happened. I mean, we didn't hinder anything with reducing taxes in the state of New Hampshire. We're actually moving far ahead. I think we need to see if we can't put these tax reductions in place a little quicker than we did with the last ones. But again, I think we have to do it responsibly, and we'll have to work with the governor to see where he wants to bring the budget.
Senator Morse, appreciate you joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, Senator President Chuck Morse, former New Hampshire governor, joining us here on the program, along with Chris Sununu and Dean Spotis. We'll come back with Kerry Norton from Hope on Haven Hill after this, as Pints of Politics presented by New England College. Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House at 1 o'clock, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. I appreciate you joining us for the program alongside the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, Dean Spiliotis, and honored to be joined on the program by Kerry Norton. She runs Hope on Haven Hill, which is one of the fabulous organizations here in the state of New Hampshire, and really excited to have her with us to talk about what Hope on Haven Hill is, some of the challenges and some of the triumphs that her organization has faced so far. Kerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. I'm really happy to be here with Governor Sununu. Hope on Haven Hill is ecstatic to be open. We opened on December 8th. We are a residential facility for pregnant women in New Hampshire with substance use disorders. And we are able to take care of them and their babies for up to 12 months postpartum. We are a pretty unique program. There's only one other program in New Hampshire that's able to take care of women who are pregnant or postpartum, and that's it in Nashua, Cynthia Day program, another great program. But we're unique. We're completely unique on the seacoast. There's no other program on the seacoast, and we're also unique because we do it in a home-like setting. So we're keeping families together in a home-like setting, meeting all of their needs for therapeutic needs and for parenting and education and job training.
To me, what's so interesting is that, you know, I talk about and identify problems and say, oh, you know, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. And you have taken the initiative to not just talk about an issue, but to go out and create an entity that deals with the issue and helps to save lives. What led you to go down this path and to create Hope on Haven Hill?
Sure. I've been a nurse for 25 years. I'm also a mom to three amazing kids and three grandkids, and my own family was impacted by addiction and our difficulty in getting the treatment, despite the fact that we had insurance and we had the means to be able to even privately get care with wait lists and things like that. At the same time that that happened, my patients were, I was unable to get them into the care that they needed. I was able to help my son get into recovery, and our lives were greatly restored because of it. And I wonder what everybody else was doing that didn't have a great background and a lot of, you know, smart, educated in the medical background fields. What were they doing? And I realized they were dying and they were suffering and they were needing help. And so it just sort of made my head pop off, and I thought, this isn't okay. Pregnant women especially, addiction has a humongous stigma associated with it. And pregnant women, even in the addiction world, they are looked at as the lowest. So people that have addiction look at their pregnant peers as even the worst part. So there's a lot of stigma. And if you are going to step forward and say, I have this problem and I need help, and then there's no help available or help's available in 6 to 8 months, that's not okay. And I just said, we can't do this. We have to do something. We have to do it now.
Yeah, well, again, thanks, Chris, and to be able to sit here with Carrie, who, you know, a word that was brought up earlier was entrepreneur, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, you know, you can be an entrepreneur in many different things, but the best entrepreneurs are ones that have passion, right, and that understand the issues at a grassroots level. And what Carrie and her group have been able to do, it's just in terms of seeing a problem, finding a solution, getting results for the individuals, right? Not getting tied up with bureaucracy or legislation or all the different things that tie so many other folks up. They really just saw the problem and attacked it head on. And I think the state did a good job. I give a lot of credit in the past 6 months in the previous administration as well, making sure that they addressed it. They understood where the holes were, and they provided the support there. But none of it, the state, it wouldn't have mattered what the state did if you don't have people on the front lines of this issue that understand the issue. That's the other thing, is that you can have folks with PhDs and that study the issue all the time, but if you're not living and breathing it, if you haven't gone through it, if you don't understand what this it is what we call kind of that affliction of addiction. It's a lifelong struggle. And Carrie's right, it has a stigma, and that's going to take time to work itself out. But we have to get rid of that stigma, because as you get rid of, start breaking those barriers down, that opens up folks coming forward and saying that they need help. There's so many folks, especially women I've talked to, who say, well, yeah, I could go to a recovery center, but I'm nervous I'm going to be, you know, removed from my family setting. Or if my kids have to come with me, they're going to be out of their right. schools. So where we put these recovery centers, where we put these beds, where we put the help that people need, geographically, even speaking, is an important thing. So while we have, is it 8 beds now?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so we have 8 beds over on Hope on Haven Hill, which is terrific. I've said it before and I'll keep saying it. I think we need 10 more of them. I do, because they have to be geographic. They have to be regional. You want to keep them in that home setting, in a comfortable setting. That's where you're going to have the most probability for success. And what they've been able to do is just tremendous.
So two-part question for both of you on this. How, as a state, do we go about empowering and allowing individuals like Carrie, who have an idea, who have a passion, and want to see that come to fruition? How do we make that? How do we create an environment in which they feel compelled and are able to do so? A and B. You mentioned the need for this entity or entities like it across the state that mirror what they do. Do you see that being, individuals like Carrie who step forward and do so as a community level, at a community level, or do you think there needs to be kind of a Hope on Haven Hill type of model that's created that stretches out across the state? So we'll start with Carrie on that, and then we'll hear from the governor.
So I think that it is the people on the ground level that are going to do it. I definitely believe that it's grassroots people that have a deep passion for this that are going to be able to do it. What they need to do is to be able to have the assistance of our state agencies to be able to work with them. And the agencies all need to be able to be run efficiently with these grassroots organizations. I know myself, besides having more Hope on Haven Hills or entities like that, I know that we also need the next phase. We need the next level. There's not a sober, supportive home for women with children in New Hampshire. There's none. And more than half of my residents have expressed anxiety over the fact that even if they're here with us for, you know, the maximum amount of time, which they all want to be, which is also incredible, they're all anxious about what that next step looks like. And we have assured them that we're going to get them to a place, you know, with them, that they're going to be really, you know, doing a great job. They'll be able to be at a place where that they can have, you know, a greater living arrangement, a job, you know, daycare if they need for their babies, things like that, and that we'll be there for them. but a lot of them know that they need that next level, that they need a sober living for their children and for themselves. And so that's definitely on our radar, that that needs to happen next as well.
Really providing that gateway, right?
Yep.
That pathway. So, I mean, you can treat someone with substance abuse. You can provide maybe it's in-house residential treatment or peer-to-peer counseling, whatever it is. I mean, there's different types of recovery services that work for different folks. But providing that pathway back into, I hesitate to use the word normal, but a normal lifestyle, back into getting a job, back into finding childcare for their children, so they can kind of re-enter the workforce and again, feel like themselves again. I mean, that's what this is all about. You can't just say, well, your 12 months is up, here, thumbs up, good job, good luck. That we can't do that. But right now, that's kind of the system we have. Going back to what you brought up first is, what else can the state do? We have a bureaucratic system. I mean, we have well-intentioned folks, and we have folks that want to see the best, but there's no doubt we have bureaucracy and regulations that get in the way. I originally met Kerry when Hope on Haven Hill was kind of an idea going to conception. They applied for a grant, I think it was, at Health and Human Services, and the grant was canceled. We didn't even realize. I was just trying to make sure that the commissioner moved it along, and he came back and said, no, that was canceled. And I'm like, well, wait, what? We didn't even know. So I said, well, how can this be that we've canceled the grant? Why is it? He had to go back and look. And again, this isn't a disparagement on Health and Human Services, but it was more of a symptom of a real problem, right? So what other organizations out there are trying to get funds, are trying to get support, but are hitting roadblocks along the way? Are we creating a system where you have to hire the $20,000, $30,000 lawyers just to navigate the process? Like, that's not going to work for folks, and that's going to be disenfranchising for those like Kerry that want to go. Now, thank God Kerry had the perseverance and kept pushing and knew which doors to open. And not everyone knows that. So we have to be much more, I call it, customer service friendly in terms of how people are going to interact with the state, whether it's getting a grant or looking for services, finding Medicaid for a loved one. It could be anything. But we have to make it a much simpler process to get folks the services that they and their loved ones need.
Dean.
Two questions for you folks. Governor, first question is about Medicaid expansion. We know that the future of the Affordable Care Act is uncertain right now. Here in New Hampshire, we've got about 50,000 people on expanded Medicaid. There's a real overlap there in terms of the vulnerable population we're talking about, need for recovery services, drug and alcohol addiction. Are you confident that if the ACA is repealed, that group of individuals who need these kinds of services, that there will be something in its stead, that they won't fall through the cracks?
Well, I mean, so what we're looking at now, and that's exactly the question that the federal government, the Senate and the House and down in Washington, D.C. are looking at. The number one message that we're pushing back from New Hampshire is don't repeal and wait. That's going to be a disaster, frankly. That's going to cause so much uncertainty in the system. What we're really asking for is making sure that we have flexibility in the state to devise a system that works for, that meets our needs and our demographics. So when you're looking at whether it's expanded Medicaid, traditional Medicaid, really the ability to now get block grants.
I was just going to ask, are you confident that even with a slightly smaller block grant in its place, you'd be able to serve the population?
There is no doubt that of the money that this state gets, we have costs that we are forced to spend money on that don't really have anything to do with the needs of the state of New Hampshire. So that by providing some more flexibility in that system, we can become so much more efficient in terms of how we put it out. Everything from as simple as paperwork to actually allowing certain groups to be able to come and apply for funds that right now might be cut out of the system. So that type of flexibility, again, isn't just providing flexibility on the government's end. It's making sure that we transfer that flexibility right down to the end users, to the Kerrys, to the Hope on Haven Hills. You talked about Cynthia Day. That's another one. I mean, there could be so many other organizations out there that we have to start promoting. And when we have the flexibility to do that, we're going to see some really great results.
And one more question, perhaps both of you can weigh in on this one. We now know that recreational marijuana is legalized both in Maine and Massachusetts. Some people say it's a matter of time here. The argument over marijuana, as some people believe, it's a gateway drug to harder drugs or opioid abuse and a variety of other issues. Others say that's not really the case and that it should be legalized. I'm just curious to hear your position on all of this and then also kind of your experience talking with people who may be part of that population.
I don't think the state of New Hampshire is any place to start fully legalizing marijuana. When you look at some of the issues that have arisen in other states that have tried this, I know it sounds good from a tax, you know, tax it and get the revenue from it. There are massive unintended consequences that, that can arise from this, and states that have already taken that step are already seeing a lot of those problems. What's going to happen with Massachusetts and Maine? I think we have to wait and see, because we're going to have issues right here in New Hampshire, right? Even the legislature, I believe, in Massachusetts has already kind of put a temporary halt on that until they kind of wrap their arms around what it's really going to mean. So I just don't think we're in a position for that right now, especially dealing with the opioid crisis we're dealing with today.
I think that it would be I think it could be a dangerous thing in the crisis that we're having right now. I think that it would be a really good thing to decriminalize, you know, to make sure that we're not spending all of our resources criminalizing it.
Final thing.
And people have to understand decriminalizing and legal. Those are two very separate issues, actually. One is just getting our penalties in line, so we're not sending people away for years and years in jail because they had a small bag of marijuana, whatever it might be. The other is fully legalization, which opens up just the doors for so many different problems.
Final thing with Carrie on just Hope and Haven Hill and what you have, you know, seen in your time there, which is obviously brief at opening on December the 8th. Obviously, you know, drug addiction has its successes and its failures, and individuals a lot of times fail a number of times in order to succeed. What is it like, you know, for you seeing this come to fruition and seeing the real stories that exist kind of beyond the statistics of drug abuse?
I have a house full of grateful, cared for women that every single day I actually have to take a pause, and it almost makes me cry, because people don't realize, because even if they see us in the community, because we go out and do community things, and you know, they look, you know, they're these beautiful people that look just like you and me, who a month ago did not have a house. They didn't have a place to live, and some of them had only the clothes that they came in. So it's pretty emotional. We're doing a lot of, we're grateful to be able to do this work, knowing that there's so much more that we need to do.
Okay. Don't start crying.
The other thing I do want to mention, though, sure, when we were talking about the decriminalizing, is I do think that the only other thing I think about is that we need to fully fund the alcohol fund.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the flip side, is we, you know, taxing this or this and that, you know, we you know, when we make a great deal amount of money on alcohol sales, you know, we need to be able to fully fund that alcohol fund, which has not happened.
And spend the money.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the other issue, to have the money there, but to actually spend it. Even when we underfunded it, there was some questions about whether we even spent the money that was there.
Right.
So there is need, right? So get the money out the door. Stop letting the bureaucracy and the kind of internal politics slow things down. And I think if we can break down those barriers, we're just, you know, there are people suffering today.
Yeah.
Right now, today, within a half a mile of here, there are hundreds of people that are dealing with this issue. And across the state, there are tens of thousands, right? So it's about getting the need is there. Get the resources out, and let's start turning this thing around.
Well, Carrie, I can't say, you know, how inspirational you are to a lot of people across this state, and to myself included, because a lot of people talk about doing things, and you've obviously stepped forward and done it, and are trying to do something good that'll benefit your community, and that's very much to be applauded. Appreciate you joining us for Pints and Politics.
And everyone should follow. I mean, everyone should follow Hope on Haven Hill and Carrie. And I've said this before: if you just want to relax a little bit, go home and follow these guys on Facebook with the live Facebooking and what goes out. I mean, it's really great. You can follow their journey. I mean, it isn't just a post here and a post there. You really can follow their journey. Everything from starting this process, you know, rebuilding the entire house, and even today, everybody gets involved over there, and they're always posting out to promote that kind of message. And that's what's going to help break that stigma.
You can either follow Antonio Brown, the Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver, on Facebook Live, or Kerry Norton, your choice.
Kerry Norton's the winner on that one, trust me.
The residents watched our iLive of our ribbon cutting, and all eight of them, I had to pause it twice because they cried. Because
wow.
They have not felt supported in so many aspects of their lives for so long that they watched as the governor-elect, and representatives from the Senate and Congress all spoke, and then they heard from my co-founder and myself and the woman that inspired us, Abby Lazotte, to do this. And I had to pause the video twice because the residents cried so hard because they had not had support in their lives for so long. And so they watched as an entire state supported them for the first time.
Well, Carrie,
it's real and it's working.
Yep. Carrie, really appreciate you joining us, and best of luck with Hope on Haven Hill. This is Pints of Politics at the Brawley House, presented by New England College. We'll come back and wrap things up with Governor Chris Sununu and Dean Spildes after this.
Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Brawley House at 1-9, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. Chris Ryan, Dean Spildes, along with the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu. We just heard from Carrie Norton from Hope on Haven Hill. And to me, this is, you know, what New Hampshire should be, right? I mean, this is one of the, this is a story that New Hampshire, you know, wants to have moving forward.
It's a tremendous story. What Carrie has done is just, you can't, I mean, there's a reason why she, her name comes up a lot. She's kind of being very championed around the state, but it's justified. She simply saw a need and would not be stopped until we did something as a state and as to just help support her vision. And her vision is an absolute home run. And I said it before, we need to take her vision and copy it across the state in a variety of different areas and break down those barriers. Is what you were talking about at the beginning of the program, really breaking down the barriers so people can get the services they need or find entrepreneurship opportunities simply to help their communities.
So you're going to do that based upon, you know, anecdotal evidence where people say, you know, this is the problem that I have with the regulation and this is burdensome. Do you want to hear from people about the problems they have?
Absolutely. We want to hear firsthand. I am not going to be a governor that sits in the four walls of the corner office and hopes things get better. Right? That isn't management. I want to get out there. I want to talk to people. I want to interact with them. Doesn't mean we're always going to agree on the solution or the pathway. But you got to have those discussions. You got to make sure people know that we are accessible in government to providing solutions.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things I take away from our conversation today with both you and Senator Morris is the belief that both of you have that the issue is not so much that there aren't resources out there, but that this is fundamentally a bureaucratic problem. And I'm just bureaucracies can be notoriously resistant to change. And so I'm interested to hear. You know, you're 2 weeks into this, and you seem confident that you can make these changes. Is that in fact the case? You
feel like absolutely you can get this we feel done? Confident about it because again, we have people that want to make the changes, but they just simply haven't been led. There's been a little bit of a vacuum of leadership in terms of helping provide that support. Right? We have great managers out there in terms of our commissioners. They do a great job, but they need to know they're supported from up top. They need to have the empowerment, if you will, to break down some of the bureaucratic barriers. It's not going to be easy. But it takes rolling up your sleeves and getting down to getting your hands dirty a little bit. But that's the job the people of New Hampshire hired me for. And Chuck Morse has already done a great job. Speaker Jasper's doing a good job. And I think together we're going to be a formidable team in terms of making sure that we're just simply providing the best darn services for the people in New Hampshire.
Governor Sununu, it's always great to see you.
Thank you, guys. Anytime.
Right. Pints of Politics here at the Brawley House. 1-9, 1450, ConcordNewsRadio.com, presented by New England College.